This is The Takeaway for Thursday, July 13, 2017. And a very happy birthday to our wonderful guest host, Todd Zwillick.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for being with us today. The country is spending another week poring over connections between President Trump and Russians. This latest episode, thanks to an acknowledgement from his son, Donald Trump Jr., that he attended a meeting in June that he knew was all about getting help from the Russian government for his father's campaign. The news was shocking to a lot of people, but the relationship between President Trump, his real estate business, and Russians is nothing new. Back in 2008, Donald Trump Jr. told a real estate conference, "Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets. We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia." That story has roots that go back into the 1980s, early in Donald Trump's real estate career. In a piece out today, the New Republic documents how Donald Trump's buildings, condos, and hotels have served as a landing spot for money from Russian oligarchs and people with close ties to Russian organized crime. The New Republic says those investments are so pervasive, in fact, that Donald Trump could never have survived in real estate or on television without hundreds of millions of dollars pouring out of Russia and into his projects over the decades. Here's President Trump in his interview with NBC's Lester Holt back in May.
I have had dealings over the years where I sold a house to a very wealthy Russian many years ago. I had the Miss Universe pageant, which I owned for quite a while. I had it in Moscow a long time ago. But other than that, I have nothing to do with Russia.
Other than that, I have nothing to do with Russia, the president says. Eric Bates is editor of The New Republic, and he's here in the studio with me now. Eric, welcome.
Good to be here.
There has been this question really throughout the campaign that's been thrown at Donald Trump throughout the campaign and the early part of his presidency. How much do you have invested in Russia? And one of the bottom lines of this piece seems to be that that question really misses the mark. The real question that you raise here is not how much Donald Trump has invested in Russia, but how much Russians have invested in Donald Trump.
That's right. We decided to go back and look at the public record to try and answer that question. What does Trump owe the Russians? How much of his business has come from Russia and in what form? And we were really struck that what's already a matter of public record shows that his entire business really depends on money from Russia and investment from Russia, a lot of which is either known or alleged to be connected to the Russian mafia and to the oligarchs who really rule Russia.
We should say at the start here, because that is laid out in great detail in this piece, that there's no evidence that the president knowingly dealt with Russian mobsters or in any way participated in their illegal activity.
That's right. We make that very clear high up. It is very clear, though, from the record that Trump hobnobbed with a lot of these guys. And after their mob ties or their criminal activities came to light, he continued to hobnob with them. So he may not have known at the time, but even after some of their criminal activities came to light, he didn't disassociate himself from them.
So let's start in the 80s, which was a critical moment in the career of Donald Trump, when Russians first started investing in the famous Trump Tower.
That's right.
Including some very shady characters and some characters who are more than shady. They're known racketeers and mobsters. Why did Russians start buying at Trump Tower and other Trump properties in the 80s?
Well, they really started buying at Trump Tower right from the get-go. And one of the central reasons was that at the time, Trump Tower was set up to be one of the only two residences, apartment buildings in New York City that you could buy units in anonymously. So that made it an ideal vehicle for money laundering. And the Russian mob had a lot of money to launder at the time. So they would buy these apartments in Trump Tower, wait for the property values to go up, sell them, and then their money is suddenly clean. We document the case in 1984 of a guy named David Bogatin. He had arrived in New York City practically penniless. I think he had $3 in his pocket. 7 years later, he walks into Trump Tower, plunks down $6 million to buy five condos in Trump Tower.
Five
condos.
Why would someone buy five condos?
There's really no reason, except if you had a very large family or you wanted to launder a lot of money. Trump personally attended the closing with Bogatin, and it then turned out that Bogatin was in fact connected to the Russian mob and was using the apartments to launder money for the mob, and his apartments were seized because the FBI said that that's what they had been used for. So
were there other Bogatins at this time? Was he alone in this type of activity?
As best we can tell, that was sort of the beginning of the process. Bogatin had ties directly back to a guy named Semyon Mogilevich, who was considered the boss of bosses of the Russian mob. Bogatin's brother had run a racketeering operation with Mogilevich, and this began a process where Mogilevich's sort of henchmen, who he had sent over to the United States, began to use Trump properties, including Trump casinos, as money laundering operations.
So that's the 80s, the beginning of this story. But then you tell the story that in many ways is about the 90s, because Donald Trump, the real estate developer at that time, crashes. His businesses owe billions. He's personally on the hook for something like $800 million in debt. At the same time in Russia, the ruble crashes, and there's this perfect storm of events. What happens in the 90s?
So when the ruble crashes, a lot of money starts to leave Russia. Experts have estimated that since the 90s, something like $1.3 trillion has flown out of Russia, and all of that money had to go somewhere. At the beginning of that period, as you say, Trump was really in trouble, and he started to build a place called Trump World Tower. It was going to be the world's largest residential building. He finished it in 2001, right after his first run that most people forget about for the president on the Reform Party ticket. And immediately, the Russian cash flows in. A third of the units on the priciest floors get bought up by Russians. The real estate brokers kind of can't keep up with the demand. They're selling to Russians right and left. This property, for some reason, is really hot with Russians, including some who later prove to have ties with the mob or are assassinated on the streets. So from that, I think Trump apparently sees a business model, because he then begins to make this a really fundamental part of his operation. He does a deal in Sunny Isles, Florida, which is just outside of Miami, to build a condo there with his name on it. He doesn't have to put up a penny, but he's going to get a big chunk of the profits. And once again, the Russian money flows in. A third of the units are bought up by Russians. Some 700 of the units are bought by these shadowy kind of shell companies that are designed to hide the true identity of the owners. Something like 65 people in those units are found to have ties to organized crime. So the whole business model of Trump becomes one of Russian money flowing into his property.
So we've been to the 80s. We've been to the 90s. The 2000s sees a lot more real estate activity, of course. We're just up the street here in New York from a grand, tall building, the Trump Soho Hotel, which has a story of its own.
Yeah, the Trump Soho is particularly interesting. Trump was approached by two businessmen from Russia, both of whom had ties to some of the most corrupt oligarchs in Russia. And they again offered him this deal where we'll build a bunch of buildings, including the Trump Soho. You'll take a big chunk of the profits. You don't have to put up a dime. All we want is your name. He became very friendly with these guys. In one case, he went to one of their daughter's weddings and her son's bris. In another case, he was taken to a lot of business meetings with Russians and kind of introduced to a lot of Russian investors. At the center of this was a guy named Felix Sater. Felix Sater ran the operation for these two Russian businessmen, and he became very, very friendly with Trump. He worked in Trump Tower. He flew around with Ivanka and Donald Jr. By his own testimony, popped in and out of Trump's office all the time to discuss business deals. He himself had family ties to Mogilevich. His father was apparently a mob boss for Mogilevich. He spent a year in prison, Felix Sater, for stabbing a guy in the face with a broken margarita glass in a bar fight, and then was busted in a racketeering league, got out by turning informer. So this is the guy who's popping in and out of Trump's office, hanging out with him, doing business with him, helping to build the Trump Tower. Trump, in a deposition, later said, oh, he could barely remember the guy, couldn't identify him if he was in the room. But even after Sater's criminal act pass came to light, he continued to be close to Trump. He was given a Trump business card from the Trump Organization and apparently was involved in the Michael Flynn imbroglio, helped draft a plan that was given to Flynn to lift sanctions on Russia. So not only was doing business with Trump, but it was influencing Trump's policy once Trump took office.
So Eric Bates, all of these names and characters, some of them shady, many of them criminals, in and out of the picture here that you've drawn for us. Over the arc of this story, how important is Donald Trump's credit, his ability to borrow from the types of banks that usually finance real estate deals and international deals. How important is that factor?
Well, it's important because he had really lousy credit during much of this time and because a lot of his businesses were going through bankruptcy. So he was in constant need of big infusions of cash. He needed money to keep flowing in. He had personally vouched for a lot of the debt, so he was on the hook for it. So that's why the Russian money is so important, because it propped up his business time and again at very crucial junctures. Equally important is it helped burnish his image. A lot of the Trump operation, as has been well documented, ran on the image of Donald Trump. There was no reality to it, but as long as people kept believing, he could keep making money. And the Russian money kind of helped set him up to look like a successful businessman. At one point in the story, we write about how the Russian money was really, in a way, responsible for his becoming the star of The Apprentice. Because at the time, as you said, his business was about to fail. The Russian money saved him. It created this comeback narrative. I'm the smart, genius businessman who was on the ropes, but I fought my way back using only my business savvy and my New York toughness. The part that he leaves out of that equation is Russian money. And without the Russian money, there wouldn't be a Donald Trump as we know him.
So the bottom line for you, Eric Bates, whether he knows it or not, how important has Russian money, and more than that, Russian organized crime money, been to Donald Trump?
The Russian money, and a lot of it from organized crime and the mob, has been absolutely crucial to making Donald Trump the man we know today. It bolstered his business at a time it was about to fail. It helped launch his career as a reality TV star, and it effectively helped launch his campaign for the presidency, because without that Russian money, Trump wouldn't have the narrative that he has of being such a brilliant businessman.
And before I let you go, I want you to listen to this statement from the president himself in May on NBC once again.
I have had dealings over the years where I sold a house to a very wealthy Russian many years ago. I had the Miss Universe pageant, which I owned for quite a while. I had it in Moscow a long time ago. But other than that, I have nothing to do with Russia.
Eric Bates, based on your reporting at the New Republic, is that a lie?
Yes, I think that's absolutely a lie, or it's a downplaying, it's a distancing of himself from something he knows to be true, which is that he actively sought out business in Russia almost from the beginning of his career as a real estate developer, depended on that money for his business. The part of it that's most shocking is for him to say that we stayed away from Russia. He went to Russia personally and courted business from Russia assiduously throughout his entire career.
Eric Bates is editor of The New Republic. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And the president has been talking about what would happen if the Senate does not pass a health care bill.
Well, I don't even want to talk about it because I think it would be very bad. I will be very angry about it. And a lot of people will be very upset. But I'm sitting waiting for that bill to come to my desk. I hope that they do it. They've been promising it for years.
That's the president speaking last night with evangelical broadcaster Pat Robertson. Senator Mitch McConnell, meanwhile, is now pushing ahead with a newly updated version of the Republican health care plan, hoping to find the necessary Republican votes that the first version never got before the July 4th break. Here to tell us what we know about the new version of the bill that's coming out today and its chances of survival in the Senate is Russell Berman. He's senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Russell, welcome back.
Thank you. Hello.
What do we know about what's in this latest version that's just emerging?
So this has a lot more money for to help lower income people pay for insurance, but it also allows insurers to sell plans that would not conform to Obamacare standards, including protections for people with pre-existing conditions. And that's a big win for conservatives.
So it sounds like you're describing two things. The first thing you said, Russell, was more money for low-income people to buy insurance. And that sounds like maybe some help for Mitch McConnell's effort to impress moderates to get their votes.
Right.
And then another part of the bill that you described that says letting insurance companies out from under a lot of regulations that the conservatives might like.
Right. So the idea is that there's something for everybody, all of the critics of this bill. But the question is there might not be enough for really anybody, because he's not changing the deep Medicaid cuts to the bill, the more than $700 billion in cuts to Medicaid over 10 years. And that was a big complaint for senators like Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Rob Portman of Ohio, and a few others. So he's betting that he can win these senators over with some more money to combat the opioid epidemic, some more money to help, as I said, people be able to buy insurance on the individual market. But he's trying to weave this very narrow path. And, you know, we'll just have to see if these senators like Collins and Murkowski and Portman and Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, if that's enough for them. We've heard, you know, reportedly Ted Cruz is very happy that his a version of his amendment was included. So maybe McConnell has fixed a bit of his problem on the right. But the big question now is going to be, what do the more moderate senators do?
He may have fixed some of his problem on the right, but he doesn't have Rand Paul, his fellow Kentucky senator. He can only afford to lose two votes here. One is apparently already gone. Russell Berman, you said more money. You said this new version has more money for things that moderates want to help low-income people pay for health care costs, $70 billion. You said there's more money for the opioid epidemic, $45 billion there. But where does more money come from?
Right. And so that's the other big change in this bill. The earlier version, as well as the bill that passed the House, would have repealed nearly all of the tax increases in the Affordable Care Act. And what the Senate is doing now is it's keeping those taxes on high-income people, on investment income, and another tax for health insurance executives. And that's going to give them another, I guess, $200 billion or so that they are using to beef up the benefits in the bill, or essentially to cut the benefits less than they would have otherwise.
So, Russell Berman, can you describe this political moment, though? Because after 7 years of promising to repeal Obamacare, Senate Republicans produced a bill that conservatives said didn't go far enough. Now Mitch McConnell is in a place where he's doing some very un-Republican things, keeping tax increases on the wealthy in place to use that money to essentially pay for government-funded healthcare subsidies, and it still might not work. What's happening?
Right. Well, I think the dirty little secret is that Rand Paul is right. This is not a repeal of the Affordable Care Act of Obamacare. Even the House bill was not a repeal. It repeals part of it, but not all of it. And so what McConnell is doing is he's repealing less of it. He's keeping more of those taxes in place. He's keeping more of the subsidy structure in place. And as people have pointed out, this is more now of a Medicaid cut of Medicaid reform, if you're a Republican, than it is a Obamacare repeal bill. And so that's really at the heart of this difficulty, is that conservatives feel that they've already given a lot by essentially conceding that the Republicans will not fulfill that promise to repeal Obamacare fully. Meanwhile, the more moderates who turns out never really wanted to fully repeal Obamacare in the first place, they're stuck trying to decide whether to support a bill that, even though it doesn't repeal Obamacare, would still result in millions of people losing their insurance, according to the Congressional Budget Office.
And still, if you're a Republican in 2017 and you control the House, the Senate, and the White House, you might not have ever dreamed, Russell Berman, that you would find yourself in a place where Obamacare repeal is on the table, and you might vote to keep in place some tax increases, billions of dollars worth of tax increases on wealthy people to pay for health care for lower income people. That's not very Republican.
Right. And I think that's why this bill is suffering from a public relations crisis, because neither Democrats like it, nor are conservatives excited about it. So there's not much of a constituency for this bill, but for the moment, it's still alive.
Republican leader Mitch McConnell will spend the next few days trying to keep his conference together, to keep his votes together. He's already lost one on a motion to proceed. That's the thing that gets this bill on the floor. If he loses one or two others, it's back to the drawing board yet again for the majority leader, as his conference has promised to repeal and replace Obamacare, and time's wasting. Russell Berman, senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Thanks, Russell.
Thank you.
President Trump is in Paris today, kicking off a two-day trip at the invitation of French President Emmanuel Macron. Now, their relationship got off to a rocky start earlier in both their terms, but that, of course, doesn't mean that the two allies don't share a lot of common interests in defense and counterterrorism, and Emmanuel Macron hopes also in climate change. The two leaders held a press conference earlier.
France is America's first and oldest ally. A lot of people don't know that. Ever since General Lafayette joined the American fight for independence, our fates and fortunes have been tied unequivocally together. It was a long time ago, but we are together.
Olivier Knox is chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News and a former correspondent for Agence France-Presse in Washington. I spoke to him earlier today, and he told me that Macron has some pretty good reasons to make his relationship with Donald Trump work out.
He's not just inviting Donald Trump. He's inviting the president of the United States at an event that is marking 100 years since the United States entered World War I. And that was a very important military contribution. So there was no way that Emmanuel Macron was going to snub the president of the United States a century after American troops came to French soil to decisively rout the Germans.
But it's fashionable in Europe now to snub Donald Trump because of all these contentious issues. And we've seen that over and over.
But Macron's playing a very interesting game because, remember, he recently had Russian President Vladimir Putin to Versailles, and they had a summit. And at the end of that summit, when they did a press point, Emmanuel Macron did not shy away from blasting Russian state-run media, accusing them of having acted as propaganda to undermine his presidential campaign. He did that with Putin standing just a few feet from him. He now has an opportunity to welcome Donald Trump, with whom he has some significant disagreements. You mentioned the Paris Climate Accord. That's really the big one. Macron has not given up on trying to drag Donald Trump kicking and screaming back into the agreement. But there are, as you say, there are very important common interests. French, U.S. counterterrorism cooperation was always good, but it really took off after 9/11, and it never really went away, even during the awkward run-up to the Iraq War when French President Jacques Chirac was one of the most vocal opponents. They also have a lot of common ground to work over on Syria. You know, Syria started out right after World War II. It was a French-administered area. The French have always felt close ties to Lebanon. In 2005, Chirac and George W. Bush partnered up in a fairly fruitful effort to reduce Syrian influence in Lebanon. So the French have always seen that part of the world as kind of maybe not their backyard, but their interests in it have brought America and France together, even when other interests separated them.
What does Donald Trump see in the president of France now, and why would he make the effort?
Donald Trump is, first of all, he's getting the military parade. He didn't get at his inauguration. Donald Trump's close aides, they've taken note, as conservatives have for years, of French, let's call it ruthlessness in pursuing their national interest. They've taken note of the sort of interesting nationalism that undergirds a lot of French politics. So where Marine Le Pen of the National Front will direct that nationalism into forces like anti-immigration, Macron directs that nationalism into what might be called sort of the grandeur of France. So it's France as a big player on the international stage. For Macron, that has meant mostly the Paris Climate Agreement in his relationship with Donald Trump. But they've taken note of that at the White House. They like the cut of his jib.
And yet, Olivier Knox, at the top, we heard that comment from Donald Trump from earlier in the year saying Paris is no longer Paris. Are there any hard feelings across France among the French people for this insult, this slight for their beloved city?
There might be at the level of the Paris mayor, who I think you'll remember her response to Donald Trump's comments about Paris was to tweet out a photograph of her with Mickey and Minnie from Euro Disney or Disneyland Paris or whatever they're calling it these days, the Disney theme park. There has historically been some suspicion about U.S. interests and U.S. intentions. But I'm not sure that there's any specific Donald Trump resentment, at least not at this point. Maybe this visit will turn that around.
Olivier Knox, chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. Thanks, Olivier.
Merci, Todd.
Amala warsh We have been going to the school for the past 1 year. We like it a lot. All the grandmothers learn together. Sometimes we sing. It's a lot of fun. In fact, it's very boring to stay at home. We eagerly wait for it to be 2 p.m. so we can go to school.
You're hearing there a student talking about the joys of going to school and learning to read and write. It's true, that woman is a little older than most school kids, but that's because she's a pupil at a unique school on the outskirts of Mumbai in India, founded especially for grandmothers. Most of the women who attend the school are widowed or alone, and none of them had more than a cursory education as girls. But today, that's changing. Every afternoon in a classroom made just for them, with money from the community itself. As part of our ongoing collaboration with News Deeply, we spoke with Nikita Rudrappa. She's a Mumbai-based journalist who met and spoke with these unconventional and enthusiastic students.
So the women who go to the school from a village which is about 150 kilometers from Bombay, and they are in the age group of 60 to about 90. They are farmers by profession. They have never been to school. This is the first opportunity of education that they are receiving right now.
Well, how did the idea get started to have a school for so many women who are between 60 and 90?
The root of the idea came from the fact that there were a lot of religious functions that used to happen in the village, and these women couldn't read the text. And they wanted to participate in it. So to learn the text and to be able to read the text was why they wanted to really learn.
You know, I saw one of the women who's a pupil at the school, and she says that when she went to school, girls only were educated until the fourth grade, and then they did their farming chores. Attitudes about education have definitely changed, but maybe behind some of this change is a changing idea about education for women and girls.
Even today, the school in the village is only till the fifth grade. So if they really need to study after that, they need to travel by foot for at least, say, about 10 kilometers to be able to get education. A, it's unsafe for girls to be traveling 10 kilometers on foot. And secondly, most people couldn't afford it. So if they could afford, they would prioritize education for a male child over a female child. That probably was the case why most girls in the village went to school only till about fourth grade. And I think if we talk about change, I'm hopeful that change will happen, especially now because, you know, the women are studying at an age that is over 60. This is kind of inspiring younger girls to continue education. The same women are also encouraging their grandkids to go to school because now they understand why it is important.
Well, what have some of these grandmothers, most of them are grandmothers, said to you about their experience getting a new education?
Oh, they are so happy about it. They don't really need to express it in words because when I met them, I was trying to shoot with them before the school time. And I could see that the fact that they really wanted to wrap up the interview because they really didn't want to miss school. So they're really excited about going to school and they finish everything in the house so that they can take those 2 hours just to study.
Has anyone talked to you about how they'd like to use their newfound skills?
I mean, they're over the age where they're going to probably go look for a job after studying. They are very aware of that. But I think they are more confident of just facing and being able to talk to people. And that's also a big thing, you know, because they've never had this opportunity before and they've never believed in themselves. And here is an opportunity that they have where they get, not only are they believing in themselves, but people are believing in them.
One of the women who I think you talked to said that when she was young, it was considered a waste to educate a girl. She'll learn to read, but then she'll just end up serving somebody else in some other family when she gets married, so why bother?
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, a lot of people still think like that. But, I mean, they are grandmothers now, but they kind of know the importance. So now even the grandkids, even the girl grandkids that they have, they are encouraging them to go to school because they realize it's actually not a waste. It was a cycle that needed to be broken. A cycle of belief, one may say, which was actually not the truth, but it was conditioning in a way.
Nikita Rudrappa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Nikita Rudrappa is a journalist based in Mumbai, India. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today, and we have a story from the golf world now. The Women's U.S. Open starts today at the Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey. There have been protests over the USGA's choice of venue for the Women's Championship, given the president's documented sexually aggressive behavior and statements toward women. But those protests have not spread to the players themselves. Anya Alvarez is a contributor to ESPNW and The Guardian and a former pro golfer herself. Anya, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What have the protests against Bedminster and the U.S. Women's Open been like to date? I saw at the U.S. Men's Open tournament last month that there was a flag flown over the course reading "Dump Trump."
Actually, just throughout the year, there's been several protests at LPGA events. This week, I know that they are waiting till Sunday to do their big protest. And because they won't be able to fly any planes due to the fact that President Trump is going to be there, and for national security reasons, they're going to have a mobile billboard with the same saying.
President Trump has been heavily involved in the golf world for much of his career. We know that. Has his behavior towards women, his sexual aggression, his comments ever been a real issue among players or organizers outside of protests?
So actually, President Trump has been a really big supporter of women's golf, which is why it's been really difficult to gain any type of leverage or support to move the venue. He has sponsored a couple girls on the LPGA. He gives honorary memberships to his golf courses to players. And so there's kind of this sense of loyalty to him. And I personally have not heard anything where he has been inappropriate with any of the players. But I can definitely say that he has used his relationship with women's golf to his benefit.
So you're a former pro golfer yourself. How long were you on the tour?
I played for almost 4 years.
So take us inside women's professional golf culture for a minute. Is protest and organization as likely to happen in this culture, you know, of the kind that we've seen from maybe U.S. women's soccer or U.S. women's hockey or even pro athletes like Colin Kaepernick? Is that the type of thing that goes down in the women's golf world?
No, absolutely not. It's a very conservative sport in the sense of just the people who play it overall. I think there's just too much money involved. And that the tour has grown too big that they're afraid of jeopardizing any relationships to cause any waves. And that includes the players. Even if they do disagree with something, they understand the nature of the sport, the conservative nature of the sport, and so they don't want to risk anything for themselves.
You also make the point that the league and the players don't have the same kind of relationship in this sport that they might in other sports. I mean, these are independent contractors, these women.
Yes. So we are completely on our own, even though we are technically playing for the LPGA, we are on our own and covering all our own expenses. We don't get any help. And so really, we are working hard also to maintain relationships with our sponsors so that we can afford to continue to play.
So Anya Alvarez, we've mentioned some of the protests targeting the LPGA as the U.S. Women's Open comes up. But you've made the point also that some of those protests might be misplaced just because of the way this whole thing is structured. It's hard to really figure out who could even push the button on an organized protest, even if they wanted to.
The LPGA and the USGA are different organizations, which a lot of people don't realize. And so the USGA is completely in control of the U.S. Open and the venue and how it's ran. The only way that I could have seen the venue moving is if there were enough players that came together and said, we refuse to play on Donald Trump's course. But that just wouldn't happen because it's the biggest purse of the year for the women. And I don't see any realistic situation where these women would risk their potential biggest paycheck of the year just to protest an event for a week.
So, Anya Alvarez, you've been in the locker room at many of these tournaments, you've been part of the culture. Can you take us inside the locker room, maybe in the hypothetical, where everyone's getting ready for practice or around, and the news comes over everyone's iPhones, the Access Hollywood tape, and the way Donald Trump acknowledged treating women, the things he said about women in the past? What's the conversation that goes on among the women in that locker room in the golf world?
It's very mixed. I mean, I know players who are completely against Donald Trump and who were disgusted and appalled by the things that he said about women. And then there are women on the tour who adamantly support him because of how much he has supported women's golf. And so in my opinion, there's a little bit of disconnect there because they think that because he supported women's golf that he's for women, which is not something that I believe. But the women who are opposed to Trump are afraid to say anything. And I can bring up an example of Brittany Lincecum, who is a two-time major champion on the LPGA. And last week, she was asked a very simple question of does she want Trump to show up to the tournament this week at the U.S. Open? And she gave a very apolitical answer and said, no, because I just think it would be a distraction and I just want it to be about golf this week. I don't want politics involved. She didn't say anything about her stance, where she stood politically, and she was torn to shreds. She had to shut down her Twitter account because she was getting a lot of hateful messages. She ended up getting a message from pro golfer John Daly criticizing her for saying anything negative about Trump. And so even when these women aren't even saying anything that's controversial, they're being torn apart. And so why would they ever put themselves in a position where it's going to completely distract them from doing their job?
So despite this effort from this golfer that you mentioned to have no politics at the tournament, you seem to be saying that's not going to happen this weekend. There have been rumors that the president might show up. You think he will?
Right. I don't think he can help himself. You know, he's about self-promotion. And in my opinion, I think it's really sad that there's a great possibility that he's going to be handing the champion the trophy. And he's just, you know, this man who has said all these terrible misogynistic things about women, and he's riding off the back of their hard work to get to the U.S. Open. I'm almost at a loss for words that this is 2017 and women are having to deal with this crap still.
Anya Alvarez, former pro golfer and contributor to ESPNW and The Guardian. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Is there anyone there?
Yes, what do you see?
Iceberg, right ahead!
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you. Iceberg's dead ahead because Antarctica's footprint is looking a little different, as scientists confirmed on Wednesday that the Larsen C ice shelf, which is a block of ice about the size of Delaware, broke off from the landmass of the Antarctic Peninsula. Now, researchers have been monitoring the Larsen C for a long time, and the collapse has scientists concerned about future collapses and the speed with which they could occur. National Geographic has a two-part special report this month on Antarctica, including graphics of the Larsen C ice shelf and its cleaving. Joining me now is Rob Kunzig, senior environment editor for National Geographic. Rob, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Thanks.
This phenomenon we're talking about is called calving, right? The giant crack?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So describe the calving that everyone's been watching, how long it took, and just the scale of it.
Well, scientists had first noticed a crack in the Larsen C ice shelf about a decade ago, or maybe around 2010, and they'd been monitoring it off and on ever since, as this crack slowly grew to be over 120 miles long, sort of along the long edge of the shelf. It's not the whole shelf that broke off, but just a piece of the larger shelf. And this year, that crack just started to accelerate. And in the last couple months, there have been sort of daily tweets from a group of British scientists who've been monitoring it with a European satellite. And finally, it had been hanging by a thread for weeks, practically. And finally, this week it went.
We saw reports all along, I remember seeing, of the crack expanding. If you were near it, would it have been the kind of thing at the end that you could see with the naked eye? Was it going fast enough?
I think there were days when it advanced, you know, a number of yards overnight. So I suppose if you've been standing right there, you could have seen it happen. I mean, this is a big thing at the old end, where it's been sort of like tearing away. It's like you're ripping a piece of paper off. And at the wide end, the crack was already wide enough to drop the Empire State Building into. So you can definitely see this thing. You can see it from space.
So this is, of course, as we said, and you've made the point, a gigantic chunk of ice. And the question that immediately comes to mind, Rob, is, well, what happens when it melts? Will this cause sea levels to rise if this is a chunk of ice the size of Delaware?
This ice chunk will not cause sea level to rise because it's already floating. So it's like an ice cube in a glass when you're having a cocktail. If the cube melts in your glass doesn't overflow. But the big picture here is that there are ice shelves like this that fringe Antarctica all around. And that overall, they are melting much faster than they were a couple of decades ago. There are all these floating shelves of ice that themselves won't raise sea level, but what they really are is the floating ends of glaciers that sit on ground, massive glaciers. And these shelves are holding back the glaciers. So as the shelves go, the great fear is that the glaciers will start to flow much faster into the sea. And we are, in fact, observing that. And so what's been happening over the past few years is that scientists have been revising their estimates of sea level rise upward, and as in part because of what they're finding in Antarctica, so that they're now talking about 6 feet of sea level rise in 2100.
And that's essentially because as these calvings happen, there's less buffer between the glaciers themselves.
Yeah, they're like corks in a bottle or dams. It's the glaciers are giant rivers of ice flowing towards the sea. That's a natural thing. But if you remove the thing that's slowing them down, they flow faster, and the balance gets out of whack, and you get a lot more ice falling into the sea, and that ice does raise sea level.
Still, there has been some debate. These calvings do happen naturally. This is not the first, of course. And there's been some debate about how much of an impact climate change is having on the calvings themselves. You've mentioned it is a harbinger of things to come because of the ice behind it. But do we know or have a sense that calvings like the Larsen C are accelerating or more common because of higher temperatures?
Absolutely, we do. Now, you can't say, it's sort of like, does climate change cause a particular storm, a particular drought? You can never say that. Climate change stacks the deck. It loads the dice. And so you can't say that climate change caused this Delaware-sized piece of ice to break off the Larsen C ice shelf. But you can say that climate change already led to the collapse of other ice shelves on the Antarctic Peninsula, and that it is already leading to a thinning and a crumbling of ice shelves around Antarctica, which is leading to an acceleration of ice flow into the sea. You can absolutely say that.
So Larsen C, as you mentioned, was already floating on the ice even when it was attached to the rest of the ice on the continent.
Floating on the sea, yes. The Larsen C ice shelf is the floating terminus of a glacier on land.
So talk about the ecosystem that lives underneath the ice even when it's attached, and what happens now that it's floating out to sea.
Well, you know, these ice shelves are pretty thick. The Larsen C is more than half a mile thick at its thickest, and even at the thin edge that broke off, it's about 600 feet thick. And so there hasn't actually been a whole lot of exploration under these thickest ice shelves. But just in this same issue, we've got an amazing article by a French photographer who has dove under thinner sea ice in East Antarctica, dove to 230 feet deep and took some amazing pictures documenting life there. And it's this exotic fauna of invertebrates, things called sea squirts, which are coral relatives, giant sea spiders, look like spiders. Of course, they're not really spiders. And then there's Weddell seals, fish that have antifreeze in their blood. It's quite an amazing ecosystem that we've only just begun to explore.
Rob Kunzig, a couple of months ago, we visited Montana on a reporting project. We've been talking about it a lot on this show. We visited Glacier National Park, where the scientists there were unambiguous that the glaciers there are disappearing and not coming back. That's ice in the northern United States. This is ice at the end of the southern hemisphere. Put it in context to what the ice is telling us about climate change.
Ice is probably the most visible, tangible evidence that the planet really is warming. And, you know, we're heading towards a planet that is, in some places, is going to be glacier is going to lose its glaciers entirely. The Arctic ice cap, the floating sea ice in the Arctic, is very likely going to vanish in this century. The glaciers of the Alps are dwindling fast. So this is a planet-wide phenomenon, and it has a planet-wide cause. It's global warming.
Rob Kunzig, Senior Environment Editor for National Geographic. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Well, one possible and surprising, maybe silver lining of cracking ice is music. And it's music that a lot of environmentalists hope will bring some necessary attention to global warming. You're listening to it now. The Climate Change Division of the United Nations started a project to bring maybe an emotional resonance of a kind to the melting icebergs. Listen. Arctic scientists recorded the sound of the ice melting, and musicians from around the world used these sounds in some original tracks. Check this one out. here's one more. Some of the undeniable evidence of climate change, a harbinger of a warming planet, and maybe some pleasant music to remind people on their phones and their stereos that it's happening. You can hear more from that collection of Iceberg songs by visiting our website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.